Breathing in, I know that I'm alive. Breathing out, I smile to life in me and around me. Alive, smiling to life. Good morning, dear friends. Today we have a session of questions and answers. A good question is a question that has to do with our suffering, with the practice. A good question can help many people. So please ask a question from your heart. If you have a question in your heart, you're invited to come up and sit close to Tai and take your turn to sit in the chair so that everyone can see you. Before you ask your question, we will all listen together to the sound of the bell. After one person's question is completed, then the next one can come up. There are also some questions that have maybe written down, and Fop Lin will read it out from time to time. If you feel too shy, you can write it down. But if you're shy like me, Tai said, you can write it down on a piece of paper. But you should be aware that usually only about two or three written questions are read out of many that go up. So if you really want an answer, you have to go up to be sure. Dear Tai, dear Sangha, yesterday three times you said, nothing can survive without food. Recently I saw a film that disturbed me and intrigued me. It was called Light by an Austrian filmmaker. And it was about the idea that you can nourish yourself only with prana. With chi, energy. Is this true, that you can be nourished only by light? There are scientists who have experimented in this area of being able to survive for years without eating or drinking, just on prana. That's my question. The Buddha said nothing can survive without food. So in this case, if the food is light, then that's the food. Thank you. Good morning, dear Thai, dear community, dear Sangha. First of all, I send you all my gratitude and my love. For the treasure that you are. I will read my question because I'm very emotional. My mother and I have agreed that we would help my father to stop his suffering. I think this is about euthanasia. She said, I feel bad that I didn't accompany my father all the way to his death, and what will be the consequences on my children, my grandchildren, on all my descendants? This is about listening to the teaching on life and death. This pain cannot be transformed. It can be transformed by looking deeply into life and death. There's a gentleman who practices. He's a scientist, and he said, this is a scientist named Lavoisier, he said, nothing is created and nothing is lost. He's not a Buddhist, but he practiced looking deeply into things, into energy, into matter. When we look at a cloud deeply, we see that a cloud can never die. A cloud may become snow, rain, hail, but a cloud can never die, because to die means from something we become nothing, from someone we become no one. When we practice looking deeply to find insight, we see the cloud in its new manifestations. If your beloved cloud is no longer there, and if you cry, that's because you don't see the continuation of the cloud, your beloved cloud. The cloud is transforming into rain. And it's calling to you, darling, I'm here. I'm still here. Don't Don't you see me? And this way you can look more deeply and recognize your beloved cloud in its new manifestations, like the rain. Your dad is like that. He's still here. He is manifesting now in other forms. He's right next to you and inside you. So we can always, you can always get deeply in touch with him. He's available to you now and here. Every one of your cells contains your dad. You can say, breathing in, "Hi, Dad." And I'm going to continue, Dad, what you gave to me. Your dad is always with you. This insight liberates you. Good practice to you. Those of you who have questions, please come on up. Dear Thai, dear Sangha, dear family in the practice, I'm very happy to be sitting on this chair close to my teacher. And I would like, first of all, to thank you for your presence, your radiant, wonderful presence. And also to tell you that I think you look great. That really makes me happy. And I also want to thank the community for the many, many smiles that we all share every day. Thank you. So my question is also on the question, the issue of death. But I still want to ask it because it's a little bit different from the one that was just asked. So it will be in the form of a very brief description and then the question about the practice. So I was born. When I was very, very young, I lost both my parents. So first I ran a lot in life, like trying to escape. And fortunately I met the practice. So I was interested in that thing I went through, and I've been listening to Thai for several years, and I feel reassured about what happened. But I still have two questions, very concrete. The first is, how can I, for myself, practice to be more accepting of the moment when my death will come? And the other question, it's about those close to me. How can I offer them, what can I offer them as a practice when they will die? So, this is something I care about very much. How can I be there for them when this happens? Thank you. The practice of meditation is to look into things. Death is an integral part of life. It's like the left and the right. If there is a left, you shouldn't wish for the end of the right. If the right is not there, then you're not there either. If there's no death, there is no life. Death is essential to life. We have to look in this way, just like the mud and the lotus. No mud, no lotus. So, learning to live is also learning to die. In every moment, there are cells dying. And we don't organize a funeral every single time a cell is dying. We wouldn't have anything else we could do in our life. So death is happening in every moment. In order to make life possible, in order to allow the birth of new cells, so we see that life and death are going on simultaneously here and now. And you have this desire to live beautifully. It means that in your daily life you want to produce thoughts that are beautiful, right thinking, thoughts that go in the direction of understanding and love. And it's possible to produce this kind of thinking every hour or every quarter of an hour. And you can produce loving speech with your cell phone or directly. Words that express love, forgiveness, reconciliation. And you can also act in a way such that your physical action can protect, can help, can save. And if you are motivated by this desire to live beautifully, produce this kind of thinking, this kind of speech, these kinds of actions, then you know very well that those will be your own continuation. Jean-Paul Sartre said, man is the sum of his actions. This is very close to Buddhism. The act, it means even thinking is already an action. Right thinking can heal, can nourish, can transform. Right speech also, and right physical actions. So every day we produce, we manufacture actions. The triple action, thinking, speech, and physical acts. The word in Sanskrit for action is karma. We want to produce a beautiful karma. And even after the dissolution of this body, we continue our karma, our actions continue. Nothing is lost. One thought, one word, one act continues indefinitely. And you can do these beautifully through the practice. And you can discover in yourself the nature of no birth and no death. You know that your beloved cloud is of the nature of no birth and no death. Before manifesting in the form of a cloud, the cloud has been heat, sun, water and the ocean. So the cloud is only a continuation. A cloud does not come from nothingness. From nothing, you cannot produce something. So the cloud's nature is no birth. And as the cloud cannot die, its nature is also no death, undying. So with the practice of meditation, we can touch our nature of no birth and no death. And we touch nirvana this way, and we no longer have any fear. Just like a wave rising, if it practices meditation, the wave will recognize itself as water. And if the wave knows that it's water, it doesn't have to go looking for water. And it's free of the ideas of being and non-being, birth and death. It is possible to do this with meditation. We touch our nature of no birth and no death. Then you have non-fear. You can touch this unborn, undying nature. And if someone close to you is approaching their death, you can also talk to him or her to help that person be able to drop the illusion and arrive at a different understanding of life. So when we accompany someone, we want to be equipped with this insight, with this non-fear, to be able to help the other person to die in peace and even in joy. Thank you. Faplin will read a written question. Dear Tai, could you please talk about right sexuality? I talked yesterday about the five mindfulness trainings. Which are a very concrete expression of true love. And I take this opportunity to invite you to write one or two pages on your practice of the five mindfulness trainings. There are those among you who have practiced, who have lived by the five trainings, who have touched joy, reconciliation, and happiness, and I invite you to share your witness, your experience of the practice. You can write it addressed to my name at Upper Hamlet, because we want to share the fruits of our practice with our friends living in other countries. One or two pages to share about your joy, your liberation through practicing the five mindfulness trainings. The third training, true love. aware of the suffering caused by irresponsible sexual conduct. I am determined to develop my sense of responsibility and to learn to protect the integrity and safety of individuals, couples, families, and society. I know that sexual desire is not the same thing as love. And that irresponsible sexual relations motivated by greed, by craving, always creates suffering for both parties. I am committed not to have sexual relations without true love and a long-term commitment made known to my family and friends. I will do everything in my power to protect children from sexual abuse and to prevent couples and families from being broken by sexual misconduct. Knowing that body and mind are one, I am committed to learning ways, appropriate ways to handle my sexual energy. I am determined to cultivate love and kindness, Maitreya, compassion, Karuna, joy, Mudita, and non-discrimination, Upeksha, in me for my own happiness and for the happiness of others. I know that the practice of these four foundations of true love will ensure a beautiful continuation for me into the future. We should have discussions about the third training. Sex can destroy, but sex can also be something very spiritual if there is love and a sense of responsibility. There has to be understanding and love for sex to be something spiritual. Dear Thai, dear Sangha, I would like to express my gratitude for all the wonderful moments I have spent in this beautiful retreat. I would like to thank you especially for all the moments in this retreat when you have given advice on how to live better my love with my beloved one. And I want to use this to benefit, of course, my beloved and also everyone else that I'm close to. The question I have comes from various things in our Sangha. Wednesday evening of mindfulness, I got this question by text message, and here it is. You have said that to meditate is to meditate on something. You can meditate on a flower, on a cloud, on a child. But we also recall having heard meditation is also to observe what is coming up without grasping onto it. Feelings, thoughts, emotions. So could you please explain about these two aspects of meditation? There's guided meditation and there's non-guided meditation. Like a scientist, you want to focus on a particular subject, so the practitioner also wants to understand something deeply. So that practitioner has a subject for their meditation, a cloud, a pebble, or our own fear. So we establish an object on which to meditate. We need a lot of concentration, a lot of mindfulness, a lot of concentration to be able to recognize and look deeply into the nature of what is there, the object of your meditation. But the other method of meditating is not to have a set object, a prepared object. You're just there and you observe. There's an impression or a feeling that reveals itself. And with mindfulness, we recognize the presence of that feeling, that perception, or that pain. And while that thought, that feeling is still there, we continue to look at it. And we embrace it with the energy of mindfulness and concentration. And we get the opportunity to understand that feeling, that perception. And that understanding is what will liberate you. Another feeling or perception will manifest to replace the previous one. And so then we allow our attention to rest on the next manifestation, just like looking at paintings in a museum. After having contemplated one painting, we go on to the next one. So it's for looking deeply into. These are two different methods, and what I can say about this is that the most important thing is that the meditation be interesting. So you don't fall asleep. When a Dharma talk is interesting, we feel absorbed and we don't fall asleep. So meditate in such a way that the subject of your meditation is interesting to you. And you can generate concentration very easily if the thing is very interesting. Just like scientists, if the subject is interesting, they can stay up all night long studying that subject. So my recommendation is to find a subject that's very interesting to you, and then it's much easier to maintain concentration. With a good level of concentration, you can make a breakthrough into the reality of that object of meditation. Breathing in, I know the Sangha is still there. Breathing out, I smile to my Sangha. the beloved community. Dear Thay, dear Sangha, thank you for allowing me to ask this question directly. There are enormous number of emotions coming up. And it's so helpful to come back to ourselves in the present moment. I wanted to ask you a question. That has bothered me for a long time, or I've had for a long time about the practice. I have seen in the written teachings on Buddhism, if you meet the Buddha, you should kill him. So the question I'm wondering about, in the practice, do we ever get to a point where we will question your teaching? I know this is not an easy question. To say it differently, should we really follow your teaching to the letter? Or can we, in the practice, can we go into our own truth? Thank you. There's a sutra called The Better Way to Catch a Snake. The Better Way to Catch a Snake. To catch a serpent, a snake, it takes a lot of attention and agility, otherwise that snake is going to bite you. The Buddha is the one who used this analogy. The Dharma can be like a snake that can bite you. So you have to be very careful. A dogmatic attitude can ruin the teacher or the disciple. So this is what the Buddha recommended. When you hear something, you should not believe it right away. Try to put it in practice what is said. And if that brings freedom, transformation, then you can accept it as true. So that's clear. When we hear something in the Dharma, just with our intellect, with our thinking mind, we need to reflect, and we need to try to put it into practice, and then we will see. Maybe the Dharma teacher says it, but we hear it in a way that leads to a wrong perception. There were monks who misunderstood the Buddha's teachings. In the time of the Buddha, there were monks who misunderstood and misapplied the Buddha's teachings. And that still goes on today. So you have to verify, you have to put it to the test. The Dharma teacher is there. Our Dharma brothers and sisters are here. And we have the opportunity to check, to be sure. That's why we need Dharma sharing, Dharma discussion time, so that we can better understand the Dharma talk. kill the Buddha, that is Zen language. You have a notion of the Buddha, and maybe that notion is preventing you from seeing or getting in touch with the Buddha. You have to kill that notion of the Buddha so that the true Buddha is revealed in you. God, you may also have a notion of God. Perhaps your notion of God is an obstacle. With that notion, you will never encounter God as a reality. You will only have the notion of God, which is wrong. The same is true with the Buddha. In Plum Village, we look into all of that. We say that Buddha is, first of all, mindfulness inhabiting us. With mindfulness, there is concentration that leads to insight. If a person is inhabited by the energy of insight, that is your Buddha. So the surest way to find a Buddha is in your own heart. And if we recognize that mindfulness is there, concentration is there, insight is there, we know compassion and love are there, and we know the Buddha is real and not a notion. It's not so difficult to recognize the true Buddha, the true Sangha. A true Sangha always emanates the energy of mindfulness. A true Sangha emanates joy, brotherhood, and sisterhood. It's not hard to see. And you can have a direct experience of the Buddha, of the Sangha, and of the Dharma. Kill the Buddha, kill the Dharma, kill the Sangha. That means to kill your notions. The notion you have about the Buddha, about the Dharma, about the Sangha. The Buddha is not a notion. The Buddha is a reality that you can touch right now, right here. Thank you. Another written question? A mother lost her only daughter to suicide at 15 years of age. What do you say to such a person? Before you say anything, you have to be there. And the quality of your presence can soothe the pain. If you are equipped with compassion, with understanding, with insight into life and death, your presence can very well relieve the suffering of a mother who has just lost her daughter or son. you can tell a story. Say, I have a story to tell. At the Hermitage, there is a Japanese flower bush 15 days before the new year. I cut a branch and I brought it into the house so that the heat would help the buds to open. One year, the buds were starting to appear, and I told myself, this year we will have flowers to celebrate Tet, the new year. 3 days later, there was a cold snap, and everything was ruined. There were no more buds for the new year. The conditions were not favorable. Were not favorable for the opening of those flowers. But 1 week later, I was doing walking meditation. I saw that new buds were manifesting. And I knew that that year I would have flowers to decorate the altar of the Buddha. You can tell that woman this story. When conditions are favorable, the flower manifests. And when conditions are no longer favorable, it hides itself to reappear later. Your daughter is a flower because all the favorable conditions did not come together. She's now hiding, and it's the time for us to prepare for the moment when conditions will be favorable again. You can tell her a story like this because you already have that insight into no birth and no death. You know there is no creation, there is no destruction, there is only manifestation. Or cessation of manifestation in order for another manifestation to occur later. I think manifestation is a word that it comes closer to the reality of things than the word creation. Creation implies that from nothing you make something. There's like a beginning, a first cause. But in reality, there is no beginning. Things simply manifest based on conditions, and they cease their manifestation to manifest again. So this story can soothe the pain of the mom. You can tell her, her daughter is still here. Now we use our time and our energy to prepare for her next manifestation, and we will know how to do better. So the mom will understand and prepare, and maybe she can let go of her suffering. I've just come back from China. My sister Yangan told me, this is about non-action, Wu Wei. I'm wondering, sometimes we do too much. We want to help too much. We try too hard to bring an end to suffering. Of course, as a Buddhist, we don't want to create suffering. But maybe there's a minimum amount of suffering that is necessary. So how do you look at this question of non-action? Your presence that is fresh, loving, solid is very important in your family, in your community. Look at the pine tree in the courtyard. Is the tree doing anything? It's not doing anything, but the presence of the tree that is wholesome, healthy, is important for all of us. If the tree is less than a tree, then we are all in trouble. So the tree has to be a real tree. Non-action is very important. If a human being is less than a human being, it will be a catastrophe. So we have to be a real human being, and as a real human being we need to have enough understanding and compassion. So this practice that nourishes us, that heals us, that brings us a pleasant, refreshing, beneficial presence is very important. So in the light of this practice, action, non-action, is already action. Being there, you know very well, if there is a presence like that in the family, everything will go well. If there's a person like that in the community, everything will be okay. So non-action is very important. We should not underestimate non-action. It is goodness, compassion itself. We have to be beautiful, we have to be compassionate, we have to be understanding. Without that foundation of understanding and love, the action can be harmful. We think the action is necessary, but if we are not at peace, the action can harm more than it helps. So action has to be based on being. Being is the foundation, and action is the fruit. We know that suffering can teach us, and suffering can be useful or useless. If we practice, we can make use of suffering to nourish our understanding, our compassion. And if we know how to practice, If we don't know how to practice, we become victim of our suffering. We learn nothing from the suffering. So there are sufferings that are pointless. With the practice, we don't suffer in that meaningless way. But sometimes suffering is important. Suffering does have its role. If a young person is suffering, it doesn't know how to have love. It is understanding of that suffering that can help lead to the way towards love. When we can understand the suffering, when we begin to understand the suffering, that is the foundation for compassion. So suffering can be important, but there are sufferings that are completely useless. And we want to help prevent people from suffering in such a way. For me, the Kingdom of God, the Pure Land of the Buddha, does contain suffering. It's like a lotus pond. If you want lotus flowers, there has to be mud. We all can agree that in the Kingdom of God, there's understanding and love, of course. Without those things, we cannot call it the Kingdom of God. But to nourish understanding and love, there has to be suffering. That's why I am sure that in the Kingdom, there is suffering. No doubt about it. And the Kingdom is here and now. We should recognize suffering as a necessary and important element in the production, the construction of compassion and love. Dear Thay, dear Sangha, yesterday I participated in 65 on the 5 mindfulness trainings. I was happy to share about the 3rd mindfulness training on love. And after that there was the 4th training, loving speech. And what that person shared caused me to touch a deep suffering in myself, which up until now I had not touched in its nature, in its essence. And I don't know how to free myself. Maybe it's wrong view. I feel very guilty for an act I did not commit, coming from war, from the past, from ancestors of my mother, who is German. My dad had a first marriage with a Jewish woman, and 2 children. The girl committed suicide when I was 12. I worked on this a lot to overcome this suffering. I think I have been partially successful. But here I touched the fact that I hadn't touched until now, that I felt so guilty to have survived. That she couldn't live and that I'm living, I'm here. And I want to thank the Sangha, the jewels of the Sangha, the Dharma, the Buddha, and Thay, for bringing your happiness and your joy. But I'm also having some difficulty receiving, accepting them. So how can we liberate ourselves from guilt for something we didn't do? We know very well that the suffering of our ancestors is still there. And the suffering of our parents. This suffering has been transmitted to us, along with the other elements like joy and happiness, experience, knowledge. And that is why meditation is for dealing with that suffering. For example, fear of death. At the moment of our birth, we're very afraid. For 9 months, our mom breathed for us, ate for us, was very comfortable in her womb, but as we start to be pushed out, it's terrible, very difficult. You have to take your first breath in. The child has to do it, and no one has taught him or her how to survive. You've got to take that breath in, the first breath. There's liquid in your lungs. You have to do something to expel that liquid before you can breathe in. It's a very dangerous, difficult moment. You could die. So the fear of dying already existed at that moment, and it continues. With the fear of our parents, the fear of our ancestors. The fear of not surviving. The fear of hunger. Our parents, our ancestors may have gone hungry, and that fear is in us. So the child who suffered is still alive in us, and that child is closed into a room, a very dark room. Every day, every night, that child watches films of the past and looks at them. And that's why there's suffering in us day and night. So we have to come back to the child. We have to talk to the child. We have to embrace that child with a lot of gentleness. And that is exactly what a meditation practitioner should do. We have to talk to that suffering child, to the suffering in us. In the practice, we know that in the present moment, there is sun, trees, flowers, the Sangha, the Dharma. There's a possibility to be in peace, in safety, security. To have happiness. We don't need to fear. The child may have been abused. She's afraid. He's afraid. We have to talk to the child. Dear little sister, dear little brother, the situation has changed. We have grown up. We're an adult. We have become an adult, you and I. And we can defend ourselves now. We can even call the police. So come out with me. Come out of the past. Let's enjoy the present moment. The kingdom of God is here. The Pure Land of the Buddha is here. There's rain, sun, birds, everything. Come out with me. You have to talk to the child who's suffering every day. Take the hand of that child and help him or her come out and come into the present moment. So every time we do walking meditation, bring along that child to walk with you. Every time you take the sitting position and enjoy each in-breath and out-breath, invite the child to do the same thing with you. Don't leave that child alone in that dark room. The past is no longer here, that's what the Buddha said, but the child is still living in that past. The past in terms of films being projected. Those films are continually being projected in that dark room. Let's suppose that we're in a movie theater. Watching a movie. At a certain moment, everyone in the room is crying because of what is happening in the movie. But the things on that screen are not real. It's just a film. If someone invited you, if I invited you to come up with me to the screen and touch it, we wouldn't touch men and women. It's just flickering light. The thing is not real, but the tears you cry are real tears. But what's happening on the screen is not. So we have to talk to that child and tell him or her the past isn't here anymore. Those are just images and you have to get out of there. You have to join the present moment. And this is our practice of each day when we eat, when we walk, when we sit. That is the miracle of the practice of mindfulness, bringing the child out so that he or she can be here and be happy. There are people who have been able to work that miracle. We have to save the child with the Sangha, a community of practice. Everyone can do the same and heal the child, transform the suffering transmitted by our parents and our ancestors. This is doable. This is a written question about right livelihood on the Eightfold Noble Path. This is an artist who does works in advertising, working to promote great consumption doesn't make sense for me. How can I be more useful to society? I think you can act according to the fifth mindfulness training on mindful consumption, responsible consumption. Because the fifth training is about food, consumption. If the artist can help people get in touch with what is beautiful, what is good, what is healing, what is transformative, that is good. It is possible for artists to do this. So you can start by only accepting to draw what has the power to help people get in touch with healthy things, refreshing, healing, nourishing, beautiful things. You can begin to refuse to work for propaganda of toxic elements in the marketplace. You can start to, with your practice, your meditation, look for opportunities to create, draw in such a way that you bring about transformation and the enjoyment of positive things, healing, nourishing things that are available in the present moment. When I do calligraphy, for example, I write, "Breathe, you are alive." It helps people to come back to the present moment and touch the wonders of life. And you can do things like that because people aspire to happiness. They aspire to consume elements that bring happiness. It's possible. We should reflect. We need a little bit of meditation to do this. When we organize a session of practice, when we build a meditation hall, we need artists. The artist can do a lot to help us be happy. Songs, drawings, architecture. These kinds of things can help us practice mindfulness, concentration, and insight. So if you think in this way, you can find a livelihood that goes perfectly together with compassion, awakening and understanding. Maybe we have to go through a period when we have to consume less. But it's very joyful to be able to make this transition. We need a little courage to make this kind of change in our lifestyle. But it's always possible. We can get a smaller house, a lower salary, a more humble car, but we have a lot more joy because we know that we're on the beautiful path, the path of understanding and compassion. Sangha, I want to ask your advice. I'm very interested in your teachings, which I think are very correct. My problem is that I'm also very interested in other teachings, which also seem very correct to me, whether that's other Buddhist teachings or Christian teachings, Hindu teachings. I would like to ask your advice. Do you think at a certain point I should? Is it necessary at some point to choose one tradition to focus on one tradition, or is it just as beneficial to continue to inspire myself with several traditions? If we love oranges, we can continue eating oranges. That does not prevent us from eating a mango or a kiwi. We are free. So you can enjoy all the traditions. There are good things in each tradition. We can learn good things in every tradition, and the good things of each of these traditions are in accord with each other. We also know that in Buddhism, as in the other great spiritual traditions like Christianity, mindfulness and concentration are very important. In Christianity, mindfulness, concentration, these are taught in a different way, with different words or notions. In the Gospel, it says, we shouldn't think too much about tomorrow. We should just take good care of today, and tomorrow will take care of itself. And if you have good seeds, you should sow them in the right place so that they can grow. The kingdom of God is a seed. That's very Buddhist. So we should keep an open mind. Even if we choose one tradition, we can benefit from others to have dialogue and learn more. Have a good continuation. My dear Thay, my dear Sangha, I was born a girl. I became a woman. My brothers were born boys. They became men. There's an inherent duality in life. Coming here this morning at 6 a.m., I felt that it was different from Lower Hamlet. I don't know if it was I don't know if it was the smell of the shaving cream or what. But you must feel the same thing when you, who are brothers and laymen, come to Lower Hamlet. I was like the boys in the beginning. I ran and rode my bike. And then later my body started to change. I had the intuition. I understood that my life was going to be different from the lives of my brothers. I would have a husband and children. This difference, it can be experienced as a burden by women because of not that just the differences in their bodies, but also the differences that are imposed by society. The perception that we're not intelligent enough if we decide to have children. I look at the Chinese delegation. I don't see any woman there. The manifestations in Arab countries. I don't see women in the street, in the demonstrations that have been going on. I'm told that I should not go out running in the woods because I could be attacked. So I have to take certain precautions. But we are one half of the participants at your retreats. We are half of your monastics.
Yeah, and people are calling out a lot more than half. It's the majority are women and nuns.
We are the majority of humanity. I would like to know, to be a woman, is that a destiny? How can we live in peace with men? When the sisters come to the Upper Hamlet, they bring us a lot of happiness. We need your presence, your freshness, your compassion. Your goodness. Here in Plum Village, we say, when we say brotherhood in English, when we say fraternité in English, we say brotherhood and sisterhood. We say brotherhood and sisterhood. Women are stronger than men in various ways. We should recognize this. If they are not out in the street with the men making demonstrations, that's because we men, we need to eat after a couple hours of demonstrating. And that's why we need you to stay home and cook. Without you, nothing can, we can't change the, we can't have the revolution. Thank you.
I do like very much to cook. But I also want my voice to be heard. I also cook. That is true, Thai cooks. I teach. But I like cooking. There's a woman in me. We inter are. Man cannot survive without woman. Woman cannot survive without man. We inter are. That is the teaching of Plum Village. Thank you. Here's an editorial comment. I don't think Thay is aware of this, but that woman who just asked that question is an intellectual property attorney, and she's offering free legal services to help us with our copyrights. Dear Thay, dear Sangha, I have a small question. Two little questions. The first, you said nothing can survive without food. Please tell us, what food is it that nourishes depression? Second, I notice there are people that I feel naturally drawn to share with very joyfully, and other people with whom I no longer have any contact and with whom I don't seek to have any contact, and is that a problem? There are four kinds of food that are responsible for our depression. Edible food, sense impressions, what we see, what we consume in terms of images, sounds, even feelings can be toxic. Even conversations can be toxic. They can bring a lot of bitterness, violence, hatred. And that brings depression. So we should be very careful. And thinking. And then volition. And consciousness, the collective consciousness. So the four foods are edible food, sense impressions, volition, and consciousness. So if our volition, if our deepest desire is to take revenge on someone, that's a poisonous food. There are people like terrorists, they want to punish. They want to destroy. That is the food that ravages them, destroys them. So we have to look deeply into the nature of our desire. If that desire is toxic, we have to change it. This is about the third food, which is volition. Running after fame, sex, power can bring a lot of pain and depression. But to have the desire to help people, to protect the planet,
to make our loved ones happy. This is a beneficial desire, a beneficial volition. The Buddha was also nourished by a desire, fed by a very wholesome, healthy desire to practice, to transform himself, and to help people suffer less. We can give rise to that kind of desire in ourselves, volition as a source of food. And then the collective consciousness, the fourth kind of food. If we live in an environment of hatred, of despair, where these are the daily food, we are intoxicated by them. People think and act on the basis of hatred, of fear, of violence. If you live in an area where people think like that, work like that, act like that, then you are receiving this very toxic, harmful kind of food. This is the group mindset, the collective consciousness. So we should make every effort to get out of that and choose an environment where there is a collective consciousness that is healthy, wholesome, sane, where understanding and compassion are possible. When we find ourselves in that kind of community, we know that that is a good environment. Everyone wants to give rise to right thinking, thoughts of compassion, of forgiveness, so we can help to build a collective consciousness, a collective awakening. That is the good environment. So the Buddha spoke of these four kinds of food. Edible food, sense impressions that we receive from conversations and so on. The third is volition, our deepest desire, and then the fourth, collective consciousness. And that depression always comes from these four kinds of food. Looking deeply into the depression, you can identify the foods, the toxic foods, and if you understand those, then you can cut off those sources of food, and the depression will have to die. And something else can be born. The second question is about is it okay that there are people I naturally feel like sharing with? Yes, we can begin with that person we like, we feel easily drawn to. And subsequently we'll be able to go to the other people. Non-discrimination, upeksha. Thank you. Dear friends, there's a little book published in Vietnam, Meditation for Busy People, for people who are too busy. It has just come out, in the French translation, just come out, just arrived in the bookshops. Meditation practice in every moment, a small guide for our two busy lives. And you are receiving in this retreat can also be found in these small books. If you would like to offer a gift, I think these would be good gifts. If you were elected president, what would be the first three things you would want to do? I would say no to the job right away. I'm happy as a monk. I don't want to be president of the republic. And what if you had no choice? I have the choice. I do have the choice. Dear Sangha, dear Cedar family, especially, please forgive me for asking a somewhat less joyful question than the one just before. It may seem very naive, but I take the risk. You said about suffering, we should cradle it, embrace it. For me, in a Judeo-Christian culture, I learned when I suffer to fight it, to overcome it, to battle against it. So this requires me to change my look, to unlearn the battle, to learn to cradle the suffering. This change is not something that can be made overnight. What can you tell me to help me to change my position about this? How can I change my deeply ingrained habit of fighting against and battling suffering and learn how to cradle it? The practice is to look, to see things in the light of non-duality. To see non-dualistically. We've spoken of the mud and the lotus flowers. We are already accustomed to viewing flowers and mud as enemies, as opposite, death and life as enemies. But in reality, they are not enemies. They are not antagonistic. It's like in the theater, the man who plays the pirate and the man who plays the hero are not really enemies. You have to have a pirate and a hero for the story to happen. So there has to be suffering and happiness for life to be possible. And suffering is part of happiness. If we don't know how to take care of suffering, we don't know how to nourish happiness. Happiness is made from the substance of suffering. If we look, in this way, this non-dualistic way, we will be able to understand. And instead of fighting, battling against suffering, we can cradle it and embrace it. It's an art. In Plum Village, we know the Sangha. The other members of our Sangha can help us to recognize and to embrace our pain, and that's why we practice taking refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in the Sangha. Taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha is something possible every day in every moment. When you chant, I take refuge in the Buddha, it may just be a chant. But when you breathe in mindfully, and you know you're there alive, the Buddha is there. You're under the protection of the Buddha because mindfulness is there. And if the Buddha is there, the Dharma is there too. It's not the spoken or the written Dharma, it is the living Dharma. Because when you walk in mindfulness, when you breathe in mindfulness, you generate the living Dharma. And you are under the protection of the living Dharma. And the Sangha is also in your heart, the community of practice that guides us. The Sangha is protecting you. And that's why to build a Sangha where you are is a very precious thing, a very noble thing to do. Because many people, thanks to the Sangha, are able to have access to the Dharma and the Buddha. That's why in daily life, walking, eating, racing, we can always be under the protection of the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha are always there to help you cradle and embrace your suffering to get relief. So that life continues. Dear friends, it is time for us to have a walk together. So this will be the last question. My question is also about suffering and insight. Every time I come to Plum Village, I discover something new in myself. Last night, you wrote a book of poetry called One Arrow, Two Illusions. And it's called Please Call Me By My True Names in English. I felt this thing like an arrow in my heart. It connects with everything you just said. I was so lost that I was afraid. When I try to reflect, I see all these scenes very quickly that I was victim of something in my imagination and in my feeling, and it was very violent. To get out of it, I talked quickly to the person I thought was the cause. But it didn't change much. I couldn't sleep. Ended the meditation this morning, talking about happiness, well-being, and joy. I felt completely separate from it. I stayed there on the earth. My question is, mindfulness is to help us deal with things. But my question is, why do things sometimes come so violently? The Buddha spoke about the second arrow. When an arrow comes and hits us, we should not let the second arrow come and hit us in that same place. The second arrow is your anger, your anxiety that will double, triple, quadruple the pain. So what we do is we have to accept the first arrow with wisdom. We should not act in such a way that the suffering is multiplied 10 times over by the second arrow. And to be able to pull out that arrow, we have to tell ourselves that you are a victim, but the other person is also a victim. The victim, that one is, the other one is the first victim, and you're the second victim. And you have the Dharma. You have the good fortune more than the other person. With the help of the Dharma, you don't suffer very much because you know how to not let that second arrow come and hit you. And you can act not as a victim, but as a savior. The other person is suffering deeply. That's why they said or did those things. And somebody needs to help. Maybe you're the only person who can help. And when this vision comes, you are free and you don't suffer anymore. This is what the Buddha recommends. And we can do this. We have done it with great success several times. Today is the Daffodil Festival. When you hear the sound of the activity bell outside, you are invited to gather at the bell tower. We will walk out to the daffodils. There will be music and tea and brotherhood and sisterhood. Thank you.